This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Schreets. It used to be that financial planning was a lot simpler, in large part because people had fewer choices. For example, more companies offered full pensions. You stayed with them for so many years, and you collected a guaranteed amount of money each month. But many companies have eliminated pension plans, and workers have to determine their own strategy for retirement. There's a new center based at the University of Iowa that plans to help people understand their economic choices. The Iowa Center for Wealth Management is now online, run by John Spitzer, UI Professor of Management and former senior economist at the Federal Reserve, and Todd Hogue, the academic advisor for the award-winning Henry Fund. This hour we'll talk to Spitzer about the new center. And later, a conversation with career counselor Kate Brooks, author of the new book, You Majored in What? Mapping Your Path from Chaos to Career. Talk of Iowa following news. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Schreese. The need for financial knowledge has become critical as many employers have eliminated traditional pension plans. That's according to John Spitzer, University of Iowa finance professor and co-director of the new Iowa Center for Wealth Management. Spitzer says this puts the responsibility on workers to prepare for their own retirement.
Wealth management sounds a little bit scary, but what we're talking about is people are increasingly responsible for their own financial security in retirement. And so this is focusing on that for the people as they work. How do I use a 401k plan? Do I even know what a 401k plan is? How do these things fit together? So we had this idea, several years ago, and if I could digress a little bit, the history goes back about 10 years ago when we started teaching classes in wealth management. My colleague Todd Hogue and I have been teaching a class in wealth management. We teach it at the undergraduate level, at the MBA level as well. And it's been a very popular class. And I had several people say, you know, this is really useful stuff and you ought to write a book about it. And the guts of the center is our website, where we have now, after almost 2 years, put together the components that constitute a real basics of how this stuff works, and it's time to make it available for those people who can use it.
Why all of a sudden are workers responsible for their own retirement plan or building and designing their own retirement plan? What's the change here?
It actually goes back to the 1930s. Prior to the 1930s, planning for retirement, there were some pension plans and a few others, and then in the Great Depression, there were big problems. And in came Social Security at that time. Now, many people think of Social Security as something that will provide for your retirement needs. It was never intended to do so. It was intended to provide about one-third. So they had this idea of a three-legged stool way back in the 1930s. One-third would be Social Security, roughly. One-third would be your pension plan from your company, and these are what are called defined benefit pensions, which means the company promises to pay you so much according to a formula when you retire from that company. And then, even back then, there was one-third, roughly, that was to come from your own savings and your own investments. But this big chunk, two-thirds of it, being provided by Social Security or your private pension. Now, what happened was, with ERISA, and I think the year there was 1974, there was a big change that prompted companies to move away from the defined benefit pension plan in favor of the defined contribution, where they say, here's how much we're putting in for you, and you can contribute as well. In fact, you typically need to. But how much money you're going to have at the end, we don't have that defined. That's how it comes out as the markets come out. Depending on what sort of allocation, what sort of investments you have picked within your 401k.
I remember my father working for Deere & Company for 40-some years, and I don't think he ever had a single decision to make. As I recall, they had a pension plan, And I think that's when he retired, that's what he got.
Yes.
That's, and that's the way that's, things used to work.
That's the way they used to work in, quote, the good old days. Yeah. Now, there were problems with that. If you, as your father did, stayed with John Deere the whole time, that worked great. If you shifted around, typically you lost, you weren't vested in your pension or you had very little in it, and you didn't get any benefits from it. So it had difficulty, and that was exacerbated as we increased the mobility of our labor force with more shifting around.
And so nobody stays in a job 42 years anymore.
Relatively few people, yes. But, you know, for retirement planning, we have to look at the bigger numbers.
Right. I remember many of my great aunts and uncles living exclusively on Social Security. They had no pensions. They had no savings. Yeah. And what you're saying, that was designed by Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, to pay only one-third.
That's my understanding, is that the intent was for it to be roughly about a third. Now, for people who didn't have anything else, having that social, it's a heck of a lot better than nothing.
So what is it paying today? It certainly, is it still around a third?
When I look at the numbers for people who retire at full retirement age, or particularly if you defer taking Social Security until you're age 70, it comes out in that one-third area for, you know, when I run sort of average numbers for an average person. Interestingly, it comes out in that range, yes. If you go to the age 70, and these are the kinds of things that we see our center and its website as providing some guidance to people on is, how do I look at when should I take Social Security? Should I take it early? Should I take it at full retirement age, or should I wait until age 70? Should I wait beyond that? The easiest answer is that last one. Don't wait past age 70 because it doesn't keep going up after age 70, except for the cost of living and adjustments.
So, Professor Spitzer, what you're saying, workers have more and more, the trend is for workers to take responsibility for their own retirement. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there's just a huge amount of financial illiteracy. That's part of what your institute is about. What do people need to do to learn what they need to know? I mean, your website is going to be a help. Mm-hmm. And on your website, I notice you can punch in numbers and get a spreadsheet that comes up. But there's still a lot of basic knowledge that people need to pick up, right?
Mm-hmm. We've tried to cover the basic principles of wealth management, what you need to know in order to have a good grip on this stuff. And this is all in the context. We don't know what's going to happen in the future, but you can't get out of the game. you have to make decisions, and what you want to do is make good decisions, reasonable decisions. And we've set up the website with the intent to provide the basic understanding that people will need. I would add here, we're looking at this website as being an organic enterprise, if you will, and we intend to modify it. We have a place in there, contact us. We solicit people's suggestions, questions, that sort of thing. And this has been one of the hardest things for me to get my mind around, because I'm old enough that I'm stuck in the pen and pencil and the printed page sort of thing. And I can't have trouble getting around that this isn't like a printed book where it's done and it goes out and that's it. This is a website where, as we see something that can be a little clearer, we can go right in that same day and change it. So I think it'll be very useful in that regard.
One of the beauties of a website, I guess, just log on, change it, and a second later it's already changed. Mm-hmm. On your website, you note that, reading from a paragraph, it says, many individuals are receiving financial advice that may be injurious to their financial well-being. So what's happening here? Is this bad advice from people that are paying for advice?
In some cases, they're paying for the advice. In some case, it's being offered free. And this gets a little bit back to your original question, Dennis, about why did we do this? There's an awful lot of information out there for managing your wealth, your savings, your investments. You have an awful lot of financial advisors who are doing this. The difficulty is that almost all of them at bottom have a potential conflict of interest. Many of the financial advisors are selling products and are compensated by their sales. So, and let me interject here. There are many financial advisors who are good people and they give good advice despite having a potential conflict of interest. But if just from the incentive standpoint, there is an incentive for those people to recommend that you buy things because they don't get paid if you don't buy them. You have other people who have structured their practice where they have a percent of assets under management. That's a little better, but it still has a little bit of a potential conflict in their primary interest from a pure financial standpoint is keeping the assets under management. And whether they grow a little or they shrink a little or stay about the same is actually not of great importance compared with whether they keep the assets or not.
So it's really hard to avoid a financial advisor without a conflict of interest, right? Because there's no nonprofit or volunteer financial advisors in this country, really. I mean, is there
not to any great extent. In terms of financial advisors and how they're paid, I have a strong preference for advisors who charge by the hour. My attorney charges by the hour. My accounting people charge by the hour. That makes sense to me.
So what are the major mistakes people are making that you have tracked in your studies and your research so far when they're trying to put together their financial plan?
Well, it starts with the major mistake that a lot of people make is they don't do any planning.
Okay, well, that is a big mistake then, right?
Typically it is. I mean, it's possible that you have enough money and it just sort of comes out you saved enough and it works fine. But I don't like that risk. And I have a little background in planning, having worked in that area in the private sector earlier on. And my observation there continues to this day is that a little planning goes a long way. You don't need to fine-tune these things. In fact, it's probably a mistake to try to fine-tune them because we don't really know what's going to happen. But to a little planning that says, I'm on a track here that looks good.
Professor Spitzer, we need to take a short break here on Talk of Iowa. John Spitzer is University of Iowa Finance Professor and Co-Director of the new Iowa Center for Wealth Management. Talk of Iowa continues in a minute here on Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dennis Reese speaking with John Spitzer, Professor of Finance at the University of Iowa and co-director of the new Iowa Center for Wealth Management.
Less than half of the workers, only 46%, report that they or their spouses have tried to calculate how much money they will need to have saved for a comfortable retirement.
Well, there's a difference between calculating how much money you'll need and actually saving that amount of money.
And then beyond that, in terms of, yes, there is a big problem out there in terms of people generally. There's a lot of people who haven't saved. The percent of people who have no savings, or essentially no savings at all, 27% said they had less than $1,000 in savings.
You can't really blame people, Professor, who necessarily for this, because if their companies are not providing pension plans or 401ks and benefits have been dropping and salaries have not been keeping up, people just don't have some extra money sitting around to contribute so much per month into a retirement plan, correct?
It is a difficult thing to do, and it's this problem that you can't get out of the game, so you sort of need to somehow or another do it. And here's where some useful rules of thumb that I've come across that I like, so I pass it along to my classes when I teach it. When I give talks on this to different groups, and this is one that shows up a lot. And it has to do with you need to keep your financial expenditures in a balance. In particular, the rule of thumb here is that you need to keep your expenditures for the must-haves, as in your housing, your car, that sort of thing, no more than 50% of your take-home income. You need to have about 30% in the like-to-haves, such as entertainment, so on and so forth, which leaves you about 20% for savings. And the general rule of thumb for how much do you have to save, it's moved since I've been following this from 15 years ago, where it was closer to 10%. It's now 15 to 20% is the general rule of thumb. So this balance of 50, 30, 20 fits into that other general rule. And what people observe is that those who aren't saving, typically it's because that first component is too big. And they think they're going to be able to cut back on the like-to-haves, but you got to have a life. So that doesn't happen, and then it comes out of the savings. I would also say that it's a fact of life that these things change in the life cycle. So there are times in your working career when you're able to save more, and there are times when you have the kids in college the car just broke down So there is some variation to it. But the real trick is I had a former student, MBA student, talk to me the other day. He has a very good job. And he said, as I think about it, if I just stayed a little bit closer to my lifestyle when I was a student, I'd have a lot of money now. So you get these opportunities, and it's very important that you take advantage of them when they're there, particularly when you're young, because that power of compounding by over 40 years, that's big.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also just important to start these healthy financial patterns when you're as young as possible, right? Just to keep
it is
year after year to keep building towards something. But you say also on the website, establishing clear objectives is one of the most important principles of sound financial planning. Some people skip this part of the financial planning process, and I'm thinking, well, if nothing else, most people would realize if they have a couple of $100,000, they're not going to want to put it in a passbook savings account that pays, what, 0.25%.
If that.
Now, at the same time, mistakes can be made. Part of it is what you call, a section on the website called administrative costs, and people can really get burned if they're not careful to keep track of what they're paying for administrative costs of a retirement fund or a similar sort of fund, correct?
Yes, we have a few levers, relatively few levers, that are important in wealth management. And one of the biggies is the cost. And it sounds like it's not much. I can easily find mutual funds that have administrative expenses that are 2% per year. Now, if you get an increased 2% return, that's great. The academic community is, many of us are skeptical about generally getting that increased return, but you know that the cost is 2%. Now, you can get a indexed fund, no-load fund, for less than 0.2%. That difference over these long time horizons that you have in wealth management, 30 years, 40 years, gracious, that ends up with a huge difference, 40% difference in terms of how much you have at the end when you take the money out compared with paying the lower costs. There are, I have read, of some 401k plans where the costs are so high that even with the matching funds from your employer, it's a bad idea to be in it because they'll have, I read of one that had expenses, I think, of around 5% per year. Now, that's very unusual, very unusual. Most of the 401k plans are well-administered.
Well, let's get one thing settled. You're not in favor of Ponzi schemes, right?
I am not in favor of Ponzi schemes, but it gets back to you. Let me take you back to your question about goals because it fits right into that. I think one of the biggest mistakes you can make is to say my goal is to maximize my wealth.
And well, now you're going to have to explain that because that sounds like a pretty decent goal.
It seems like a decent goal, and interestingly, we use it in finance when we're talking about corporate finance. We say our goal here is to maximize the value of the firm. So, and I've heard read of several financial advisors say, well, obviously, my goal is to maximize my wealth. My view, Todd agrees with me, that's, we think, the biggest mistake you can make because it will inexorably lead you to take more risk. Risk and return do go together. It's actually risk and expected return, not just risk and return, but risk and expected return go together. So if you want to you want to maximize your wealth, the only way you're going to do it is to take more risk. And now you have this vulnerability that you end up with nothing at the end. And if I could bore you with a story, which I use this in pretty much every time I teach the wealth management class. And this comes from my brother-in-law who lives in Washington, D.C. and had a neighbor who was part of the Foreign Service. And he came to my brother-in-law and said, I'm getting into something that looks like it's going to have a really good return, 100%, something like that. And would you like to participate in this? So my brother-in-law found out the details at that time. The details were these emails that you get from various places in Africa where there's a box of money somewhere and they just need some legal work done. This was the case. Now, what was instructive about this is how professional, if you will, these crooks were. His neighbor said, I need to see this money. And they had played off of his service in that country in Africa and cited some money that did disappear and various people who disappeared. So that was good. He wanted to see the box of money. He went to Houston. Was met by people who took him to a building that was marked U.S. government, federal something or other. They took him into an office that had over it something that said customs. Inside were people in uniforms who opened a box and showed him something that had $100 bills. He lost everything, including his house, because he mortgaged it to keep going as they took more and more money. And I go back to the goals. Why was he doing this? He had enough money. He was trying to maximize. And, man, you get off of that goal.
Professor John Spitzer, we need to take a break. We want to continue the conversation for a few more minutes following the break. The Environment Report will be back in about 5 minutes with Dr. John Spitzer, professor of finance at the University of Iowa, co-director of the new Iowa Center for Wealth Management. This is Talk of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. We continue the conversation with John Spitzer, professor of finance, the University of Iowa, and co-director of the new Iowa Center for Wealth Management. I remember some years ago, for people in education, there's an organization called TIAA CREF teachers, professors, others in the education business. Mm-hmm. I remember years ago that TIA CREF retirement plan was pretty simple. You had maybe two choices. And within the past few years, they've added all sorts of classes and subclasses and to the point where it's so overwhelmingly confusing. You need somebody, I think, to help you even determine where you want to put your money. You say on your website that the major asset classes are money markets, bonds, stocks, and real estate. Mm-hmm. But even if you limit it to just, you know, the four basic classes, how does anyone know what's the right thing to do without going to a professional?
Now, you say TIAA, Kraft, and others have given lots of choices, and that has been what we've seen in the financial services area. I am of the view that you can do very well without doing a lot of choices. Personally, I like indexed funds. I like indexed funds that have the total market. Yes, some sectors are going to do better than other sectors. I don't know which ones. I am confident that I can't pick them. I'm also confident that I can't pick anybody else who can pick them. I think there are people out there who probably can. I don't think I can find them. And back to our objectives, the objective that I like is don't be poor in retirement. Be financially secure. That has a huge advantage in that I can achieve it. I can achieve that, and whether I get even more or not isn't nearly as important as whether I achieve that goal that I'm not poor and I'm financially secure. And if I can see my way to do that with indexed funds, and I sort of can, yeah. They have low costs, that's the way I go. Other people will say, I want to do a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Great, do that, but make sure you have that first objective covered so you're not poor when you're retired. For many, many people, yeah. It's doable.
I was going to ask you one thing. At Consumer Reports this month, one columnist was recommending step one maybe is to, if nothing else works, pay down your mortgage. Is that mm-hmm. good advice?
That's a real interesting one because this is one of the several areas where we've had a big shift in the general thinking of the gurus of wealth management. When I first started looking into this, which is now about 15 years ago, the general thinking was, for heaven's sakes, don't pay down your mortgage because you're not going to get a great rate of return. When you pay down your mortgage, that's the same as investing at the interest rate that your mortgage has. Okay, so they were saying you can get a better return, keep that mortgage, you have extra money invested in the stock market. Well, the stock market moves up, it moves down, and sort of after the tech implosion, that shifted to, yes, pay down your mortgage. And that's pretty much where it is now, a bias towards paying down the mortgage, but there is a balancing act to it. While it's a risk-free investment at the rate of return of your mortgage, and you can't get a risk-free return anywhere else that's anywhere that close. On the other hand, most of us do need that expected higher return on some of our assets that you get with stocks and with real estate. There are young people, don't know what to do, and I put that money into a money market inside my 401k. People do that. If you're young, you can take the risk of stocks. Stocks over time, historically anyway, and they're long swings. You know, it can be 10 years, it can be 20 years. Well, if you're young, you've got 20 years. But the flip side is people, as you get close to retirement, and we saw people doing that just before the meltdown of 2008, they had all their money in stocks, but they're going to be retiring, plan to retire in 2 years. General rule of thumb we have is if you're for stocks, you really need five-year horizon plus. I really like 10 years. So for those people, it's tough to do, I know, because I'm kind of in that area, to pull back and say, I'm going to take that money out of the stocks so it's in money markets or short-term bonds.
I know some people, though, have completely given up on the stock market at this point. Just mm-hmm. no more stock market. They're not going to touch it. But that's probably not a prudent way to look at the future, is it?
For most of us, we need to have the higher return that you get with the stock market. And here's something I use in my classes. We have a little section called Myths and Mistakes that you can make. And this one is, to the to anyone, would you like to have the stock market even out and provide a nice steady return? And the twist there is, if you were to get that, it would start to look like a risk-free, low-risk asset, and you wouldn't get the return that you expect from the stock market and that it historically has achieved. So, in fact, when you see all these and they're gut-wrenching, you have to keep in mind, I actually need this because this is the only thing, this is what keeps me getting a higher rate of return than I get on those more, those safer investments.
Professor Spitzer, thank you very much. Good luck with the website and with the Iowa Center for Wealth Management. Appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about it. I've enjoyed it.
John Spitzer is a professor of finance in the University of Iowa, Henry B. Tippie College of Business, and co-director of the Iowa Center for Wealth Management. This is Talk of Iowa. Kate Brooks says we might be surprised to learn that in one study of university graduates, almost 70% reported that their careers were significantly influenced by unplanned events, sometimes known as the butterfly effect. Dr. Brooks, director of the Liberal Arts Career Services at the University of Texas at Austin, believes in the butterfly effect and that students graduating with bachelor's degrees in the liberal arts have reason to be hopeful. Not about finding the perfect job that corresponds exactly to their degree, but about eventually finding a pleasing and maybe even meaningful career. Brooks' new book is You Majored in What? Mapping Your Path from Chaos to Career. I wanted to ask you, first of all, Kate, about the so-called linear career path. You say it hasn't disappeared. Some psychology majors do become psychologists, and some English majors become English professors. But linear thinking can keep you from thinking broadly about your options. So what is linear thinking so we can learn to avoid it somehow?
Well, linear thinking as it applies to careers, really, it practically starts from the time someone's very young. You know, you have a three-year-old who starts playing with fire trucks, and you say, would you like to be a firefighter someday? You know, that idea that whatever we're interested in or whatever we study should automatically or will automatically lead to a career in that particular field. And that may have been true at one time when career options were more limited and you only went to school for the purposes of a specific career, such as becoming a doctor or a lawyer. But now the sky's the limit.
And so now you actually have a chart where you have majors and some jobs that, like an economics major, has become a veterinarian rather than an economist, an art major becomes a special prosecutor. These are all real examples, I assume.
Yes, they were taken from alumni surveys.
A psychologist becomes a cartoonist. A religion major becomes an MTV program developer. So we're seeing more and more of these unexpected turns in career paths. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think to a certain extent some of these unexpected paths have always been there. They just haven't been in the consciousness of what normally happens. I think we all, when we think of particularly in higher ed, there's this tendency to think, well, you know, higher ed is a stepping stone to a job, and therefore you're going to take a curriculum that fits that job. And it works really well if you're planning to be an electrical engineer. I strongly recommend you go to an electrical engineering program. But where, again, it does start to fall apart are some of these jobs that don't necessarily have a specific career path, such as the programmer for MTV. You know, they don't have a specific major for that. So there's a lot of different fields that could draw from.
You talk about whether one's degree equals one's earning power. You say that the most requested piece of information from college career centers is
how much will my student or my son or daughter earn when they graduate? What is the typical salary of an economics major? Or what is the typical salary of a sociology major? We hear that a lot.
But you go on to say study after study shows poor correlations between students' undergraduate majors and their income. What is that all about?
Well, you know, again, it's back to that linear thinking that, that a particular major is going to produce a large income. Now, there's no question that when you look at salary surveys, the highest paid workers generally are engineers. And so those degrees, you can sort of make a connection between what someone, what degree they earn in engineering and what their salary is likely to be. But salaries become, outside of those very specific fields, salaries become more a function of the job title itself, the industry that it's in, and the geographic location. So if you have a sociology major, for example, who takes a job in investment banking at Goldman Sachs in New York City, they're going to earn the salary of an investment banker at Goldman Sachs in New York City. If they take the job of a social worker in a small community in Alabama, they're going to get the salary of a social worker in a small community in Alabama. And quite frankly, the undergraduate major is irrelevant to that. It's the position. And so it's what position they choose that's going to determine their salary, not their major.
Kate, you write that you might be surprised to learn that in one study of university graduates, almost 70% reported that their careers were significantly influenced by unplanned events. Mm-hmm. In other words, the butterfly effect. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. The butterfly effect in chaos theory is the idea that a small event can lead to a major unexpected outcome. So a butterfly flaps its wings in Mexico, and 2 years later there's a tsunami in Asia. The idea, and when you apply that to a career setting, what we're really saying is that sometimes completely unexpected, unplanned events lead to a career choice. One of my favorite, most recent examples was an English major that was in one of my classes last year, and she went to the roller derby one weekend with a friend and was sitting in the audience watching whatever one does at a roller derby, but she noticed off to the side was a table of some women from a nonprofit women's health agency. They just were there with brochures and information on women's health. It was an area she's interested in, so she wandered over and talked with the women, and they offered her an internship, which she took, and then told her that by the end of the summer they hoped to have a job opening, and if they did, she was the strongest candidate. So going to a roller derby on a Saturday afternoon led to a job. That's the butterfly effect. It's you're doing something that's just in your normal daily event, something you know you would be interested in doing anyway, and suddenly a career opportunity occurs.
Yeah, it's just part of it is just keeping a really open mind to all sorts of possibilities, isn't it?
Exactly. And also, you know, what she did is she could have sat in the audience and looked over and seen the table and said, oh, that's interesting, and just continued to sit. It was the fact that she got up and walked over and started talking to them that led to the opportunity. So you have to reach out. It isn't just you just sit and wait for the opportunities to come to you, but take advantage of those moments.
Explain your idea called wise wanderings.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I discovered was that my students tend to wander. You know, they tend to try stuff out. There's not always a logical pattern. I'm sure there's many a frustrated parent who says, gee, you know, one week they're doing this, and then the next week they're taking up the guitar, and next week they're doing ice skating, and they've already dropped that, now they're going on to something else. I actually encourage that. The idea that through wandering, through trying things out, we learn what we like and what we don't like, and it makes it more likely that we will ultimately hone in on something that we really do like. So that's the aspect of wise wandering, is you don't just sort of wander completely loosely, but you have a plan.
You also talk about the real problems with negative thinking. I mean, that sounds obvious, but if you're just graduating, you really do have to somehow get rid of negative thinking, because surprising things can happen, and surprising jobs can happen, maybe when you're least expecting them, right?
Exactly. You know, if you read the newspapers and you're listening to the media, you're going to be, in your head, you're going to be saying, no jobs, no jobs, no jobs. And my experience is that quite often what you focus on is what you see, because you filter things out. Your mind does that just naturally. And so if you can put your head in a space where you're focusing more on what might happen, what are some good opportunities, what might show up today, I think you increase the chances of that. I actually call it in the book my Mini Cooper effect, and I believe that psychologists would call it selective attention. But I call it Mini Cooper because I had a friend who wanted to buy a Mini Cooper. She talked incessantly about it. I didn't know what she was talking about. Finally, she took me to a website, and she showed me what the car looked like. The next day, I'm driving into work, and I saw half a dozen of them. Now, I have a funny feeling those cars were there all along. I don't think they showed up just because I was driving that day. But I just didn't notice them. I hadn't paid attention. But once my mind was focused, then I saw them. And I think the same thing happens with job opportunities. You know, if we're focused on no jobs, bad job market, nothing's out there, I think that's what we will tend to find.
Kate, you write that intentions are statements and invite as yet unknown answers. They are less concrete and specific than goals, but by creating an intention and reminding yourself of it on a regular basis, you encourage the likelihood of bringing it about. Is that a hard sort of mental state to achieve?
You know, I find that it actually, the reason I developed that was it really worked for my students. My students don't do well with goals, quite frankly. If I say to them, what's your career goal? They just look at me. And most career books start with that. The first thing is write down your goal. And most of my students would close the book at that point because they'd say, well, I don't know what I want to do yet. So goals, because of their very nature, they tend to be focused. They tend to be very specific, achievable, measurable. Students aren't there. So what I say to them is, what's your intention? What would you like to have happen? And they'll say something like, well, I'd really like to find an interesting summer job. I'd like to find an interesting experience next year. Let's just set an intention for that. I'm going to find something interesting. And again, what it does is it sets a mindset. It puts your mind in a place where you're open to things. And one of my students set an intention for, I'm going to find an interesting opportunity for next year. She had no idea what her career goal was. And within a week, she had an email that a friend of hers had recommended Teach for America to her. And she got an email from Teach for America inviting her to apply. And she said, normally, I would have just put that email in the trash. But she said, I had set an intention to find something interesting. And she said, I thought, well, this might be the something interesting. And she applied for it, ultimately started working for them. So it's really just, again, it's a way of getting your mind in a positive framework for looking for a job instead of the common kind of negative, oh, I have to look for a job framework.
Chapter 8, three secrets about an irresistible resume. Can you fill us in on the secrets?
Well, to sum those up, I would say, and as I mentioned in the book, they're really not secrets. Most people, you know, a lot of career service people will know them right away, but they seem to be hidden from people because nobody does them. But I think one of the key secrets is the idea of the focusing of the resume and the idea of, can I picture what I'm writing? I see so many resumes that have marketing speak because there's a lot of guides out there that will say, write things like hard worker who accomplishes challenges in a rapid manner. And it's like, what does that mean? And who's going to say I'm lazy and it takes me forever to do something? I mean, it's meaningless. So much better to put some concrete example of that. How can you show in your resume you are a hard worker? So you might say something like, manage three tasks simultaneously involving, you know, budgeting, people, organization, whatever. You know, something that tangibly talks about it. The example I use in my book is a former student of mine who had as her job, she worked at Hershey Corp, which Hershey Park, which is an amusement park owned by Hershey Corporation, the chocolate company. And she had her job as something like public relations person, and then she put, you know, encouraged a friendly, fun environment. And I thought, what does that mean, encouraged a friendly, fun environment? And when we talked, it turned out she was a Crackle Bar. She wore this Crackle Bar costume and walked all over Hershey Park, chatting with children, finding lost parents, all that sort of thing. And it was a wonderful job and a wonderful experience. And I said, why do you have it couched in all this marketing speak? Call yourself. So she wrote, Crackle Bar as her job title. And then she described what she did. And she had more recruiters that wanted to talk to her that semester because they wanted to meet the Crackle Bar. They thought that was so funny.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's that idea of, let's get it out of marketing speak. Say what you did and back it up. Be prepared to back it up. Don't ever just say, I'm a hard worker.
Kate, you're the director of the Liberal Arts Career Services at the University of Texas at Austin, a very, very large public university, I'm sure, with thousands of liberal arts graduates.
Yes.
This is a pretty terrible time for a liberal arts graduate to be trying to find a job in this economy. Still, unemployment really high. I mean, what are your feelings? What are you telling all these students that you talk to?
Well, there's a couple ways to look at that. I think, you know, it certainly is a challenging job market. I don't think anybody's going to argue that. We are seeing some small bright spots. We're seeing more employers showing up at our job fairs. We're starting to hear about more opportunities, more job openings. Liberal arts students, quite frankly, always have a challenge when they're converting their degree into the workplace. That first transition job is usually just that, a transition. I joke with my students that most people spend their first job looking for their second job. You know, the first job I really view as a learning point. It's a transition from being a student into the workplace. You start to learn about workplace politics. You learn about a lot of things that no matter what job you're doing, you'll be able to translate that into whatever career you ultimately decide. I encourage my students to think about it as a learning process, that as long as you're learning, that it's a valuable experience. And sometimes all you learn is, I never want to work in that career field again. But at the same time, you can start to tease out, okay, why not? What don't I like about it? Is there 2 minutes of my day that I do like? And is there a way to take that activity and parlay it into something else? My first job was in retail merchandising, not my favorite field ultimately. But I was working in human resources for a while. And while I did that, one of my favorite elements of that job was I had a chance to work with, I was hiring people for the store, and I hired people who had disabilities. And I discovered that I really enjoyed that part of my job, interviewing someone with a disability and helping them figure out what they could do and where they could fit in at the store. And so I parlayed that into a job with a nonprofit agency that totally dealt with people with disabilities. And then from there, I went on to get a master's in rehab counseling, which specialized in that area. And so that was, it was just this natural outgrowth. Yes, I could have said, oh, that first job in retail merchandising, what a waste, because I've never been in retail merchandising ever since. But it wasn't a waste at all. There was that gem. There was that small element of the job that told me this is what I'm interested in.
Kate Brooks, thank you very much. This is really an interesting book. I enjoyed reading it, and I hope a lot of college graduates will pick it up. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Great talking with you.
Kate Brooks is author of the new book, You Majored in What? Mapping Your Path from Chaos, Your Career Path from Chaos to Career. She's a career counselor at the University of Texas at Austin. That's Talk of Iowa Today. Talk of Iowa, a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Dennis Reese.